In the coming week, the world awaits the results of the close U.S. presidential election. The World Trade Organization is scheduled to select a new director general, and Myanmar holds fraught elections. It's November 5th, 2020, and time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Jim Lindsay. Bob, over the last 2 days, Americans and plenty of other people around the world have been patiently watching as the results of the election come in from precincts around the country. As we're sitting here right now recording the show, former Vice President Joe Biden has a 3.7 million vote lead in the popular vote. But as hopefully everybody knows at this point, the outcome of the U.S. presidential election isn't decided by the popular vote, but by the outcome of the Electoral College. And there, neither candidate has yet hit the magic 270 vote margin needed to win. So can you give us an update, Bob, on where things stand and where we're likely headed?
Sure, Jim. And I'll note many people are wired to various maps showing color coordinated leads and so forth right now. And we're very likely to get overtaken in a few things from the time we tape this podcast. But, you know, at this point, there are several of the so-called battleground states that are too close to call. And even those that have been called, such as Arizona, there's still variables that need to be sorted out. And I would say Arizona, possibly in the course of today, will be one of the states that will know whether Joe Biden's lead holds.
And I'll note there, Bob, that a number of news organizations haven't called Arizona. I believe Fox was one to call Arizona.
The Associated Press and Fox are notable for calling it because of their methodology they use. They cite a path to whether they see a path to a victory or not. And they said they did not see one for President Trump in Arizona, despite the fact that there are votes to be counted and there's a chance that there are votes in his favor that could sway it. But we'll have to see. You know, it's as everybody's saying, we'll let the vote play out. But I'll get to why that's become controversial on its own in a second. It's worth noting then that Nevada is another crucial state where razor-thin lead for former Vice President Biden. You have Pennsylvania where President Trump is leading, but that lead is eroding swiftly. The same is happening in Georgia. North Carolina is another state that has not been called, though it seems to be more firmly going in the direction of a Trump win. And so with those results, a number of people have pointed out if you just froze the results as they appear in the screen right now in terms of who's leading, you would have former Vice President Biden with the exact number of electoral votes he would need, 270. So there is a growing sense of anticipation that Biden will be the president-elect. However, there's a very notable side to this that is going to fight that tooth and nail, and that would be the incumbent, President Trump. He came out on election night itself and has since then been challenging what he sees as fraudulent counting of votes after he had sort of sprinted to the lead in a number of these states. And he has got a number of followers who are passionately supporting his cause. He has mounted some lawsuits. He has requested a recount in Wisconsin, where Joe Biden was narrowly declared winner. And it appears he's going to contest at least three of the battleground states, probably more. And it's not clear yet how that's going to play out. But I should note that the president's declaring of a victory and declaring of fraudulent practices has been rebuked by a number of sides, by some people in his own party, as well as by actually an outside monitoring organization that was invited to the U.S., the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, the OSCE, which found otherwise a fairly vigorous, freely contested election with a marred heavily by the incumbent declaring victory. So we have this kind of pall over the results right now. We talked about it a little bit in our episode last week, Jim, about, you know, a very close election and what it could mean in terms of close vote being counted and being contested and possibly being contested by armed supporters at various vote counting areas.
Well, that hasn't happened yet.
No, although it was noted that there were some people who were showing up at vote counting centers in Michigan and Pennsylvania, some of whom might have been armed, but there's nothing that points to any sort of clear-cut intimidation, armed violence, that kind of thing. No. So the worst-case scenario is not played out. There is some pretty angry rhetoric and some threatening rhetoric on social media accounts that support President Trump. And that's been watched closely by domestic terror experts and so forth. But again, compared to what the concern was, even at this point, those concerns have not been met. And in fact, I should note, Jim, that this is the highest level of participation in a U.S. election in 120 years, I believe. President Biden's total at this point is the highest ever received by a presidential presidential candidate, exceeding 72 million. President Trump also very, very high numbers, 68 plus million at this point. And I would just add finally, Jim, it points to a situation in which there is obviously a very clear divide across the country, and a divide that is, first of all, not extraordinary because the countries have been divided before, had close elections before, had closer elections in some cases. The difference this time being is the sense of the other side really being an enemy, and this sort of vitriol and bitterness has alarmed a lot of people, and it has raised concerns about the country's ability to govern and to make some of the tough decisions that are facing it.
I should note, Bob, that the scenario we're seeing play out, the so-called red mirage or the blue shift where Trump looks to be ahead on election night, and as the votes get counted, the pendulum swings to Joe Biden, is a scenario that a lot of people predicted. So in that sense, the experts got one right. Beyond that, I think there's a lot of questions being raised about polling in this election and how off it was, not just on the state level, but also nationally. Again, Joe Biden is leading in the popular vote, but if you had believed the polls coming into the race, which had him up something on the order of 7 to 9 points, depending upon whose average you wanted to look at, you would expect an even bigger gap in the popular vote. But actually, I want to sort of drill down and focus on something that's not getting as much play as we keep focusing on who's going to be the next person sworn in as president of the United States. And that's what's happening on Capitol Hill in the congressional races and what's happening in state and local races. And I will note that it looks like Republicans are going to keep control of the United States Senate. What that means is that if Joe Biden becomes president, the ambitious plans that he had, whether we're talking about infrastructure or climate change or big stimulus package or changing the size of the Supreme Court or revamping corporate tax code, all of those things look to be dead on arrival. They're not going to change. There's, in fact, no evidence to see Republicans rallying behind elements of Joe Biden's platform. I'd also point to people on the state and local level where there was actually very little change in control of state legislatures and governorships. It's pretty much a status quo election. That's important because, again, this is the year that's going to determine the state legislatures and the governors who are going to get to redraw the congressional map for apportionment, something we do every 10 years. And essentially, Republicans have held serve. And that's significant because, again, going back 10 years where the Democrats got routed, got shellacked in 2010, sweeping in Republicans who have written state legislative districts and federal congressional districts to advance or maximize their chances of winning. That trend is going to hold, and it's going to be the gift that keeps on giving for another decade.
Those are all good points, Jim. And I think I would say in terms of sweeping changes and sweeping new initiatives, whether you want to call them Green New Deals or variations of that, don't seem to be in the cards. We should also point out presidents still hold a lot of sway in their ability to, whether it's executive actions, which President Trump has used quite a lot, but President Obama had used that route quite a bit before him, or in just the regular functioning of the executive branch, a Biden administration would be able to change the tone and the tempo of the government's engagement on a lot of different issues, and also set in motion, I think, and I'm thinking specifically in areas of response to the coronavirus, I think it would be able to do a number of things that would not require any sort of consent from Republicans per se. Other than that, I think a president-elect Biden would need to have buy-in of, say, Republican governors and so forth to follow through on any sort of nationally led initiative. And this gets down to one of the storylines that's playing out in these elections, because exit polls are indicating, as some of the polls had indicated going into the election, that the two parties and the followers of both parties are in different worlds when it comes to prioritizing the coronavirus. The Democrats, it was the lead issue. Republicans, the economy was. Coronavirus was not. The irony being that the country is facing what's being called a third wave, and actually that's highest ever daily infection rates, over 100,000 recorded just the other day, and something that's going to be with us well into 2021 by all accounts. President Trump had not indicated any sort of change in his approach to dealing with the virus, ramping up vaccine research being his main thrust, and not letting the virus sort of guiding sort of lockdown policy, and presidential candidate Biden calling for a nationally led approach to testing, contact tracing, a broader soup to nuts approach to trying to tamp down the virus nationwide. And that is going to be something that's going to be interesting to see if this plays out. There's a lot of conjecture here, obviously, as we wait for these totals to firm up. But coronavirus policy, and then in terms of getting involved in international efforts, joining this COVAX initiative on trying to find a vaccine and distribute it and sort of set a global coordinated message, that's something that would be distinctly different, one assumes, under a President Biden than President Trump.
I would actually broaden that point out, Bob. I think people overseas are going to see much greater changes in the United States than Americans will at home, because in foreign policy, presidents have a great deal more leeway, both constitutionally and practically. As you point out, a Biden presidency is going to approach issues very differently. You mentioned issues related to the pandemic, but you're going to see a variety of changes in foreign policy in terms of discussions with allies, in terms of climate change, and the rest should Joe Biden be elected president. I think domestically, he's going to be boxed in terms of his ability to do things, and you're going to see a Biden presidency sort of challenged on the right by Republicans, but I think also on the left by progressives. And I think one of the things going to happen in the coming weeks and months is everyone's going to be arguing about what the meaning of these elections has been and whose theory of the case is correct. And so we're going to be hearing arguments that Trumpism has deep roots and will persist and is the future of the American Republican Party. And you're going to hear arguments, certainly by progressives, that Joe Biden didn't present enough of a contrast. And if he had only embraced more progressive ideas, he would have done better. And conversely, you're going to hear moderates in the Democratic Party argue that it was precisely because of the fear of the left wing of the Democratic Party that Biden didn't do as well as he might have done. So there's going to be a lot of postmortems, we'll call it, and some of them I suspect will be quite brutal and unkind.
Indeed, Jim. And again, I think we're going to have to wait and see how this tracks out. We're going to have to wait and see if there is a transition, what kind of a transition is going to be, what sort of interregnum period the country is going to have, how it will affect international affairs. I would note one other thing on the international affairs front. I think you're completely right that on the foreign affairs front, there will be a significant different vibe than perhaps, you know, domestically, at least initially. And a couple of areas just to highlight that, again, going back to the Obama administration, the U.S. entering into the Iran nuclear deal and the Paris Climate Agreement were arrangements that the president was able to orchestrate without requiring any sort of Senate buy-in or anything else. It would have liked to have had them. President Obama faced immediate backlash, actually, as the Iran deal was being finalized, really strong backlash from some Republican senators. And they were very eager to peel that back when President Trump was elected. So those are kinds of things that a president can do, has the leeway to do. But in other areas, it gets trickier. There's a whole bunch of areas where you're gonna want the Senate buy-in, and whether it gets to appointing cabinet officials or...
Not just want, you're going to need.
They're going to need, yes, as well as things like arms treaties and other things. So hold on, we've got a lot more going on and a lot more to talk about in subsequent podcasts regarding a possible U.S. presidential transition. Jim, I want to turn to another area where a new U.S. administration could have quite an impact, and that's the World Trade Organization. We've discussed this before. We discussed that it's dealing with a leadership change. Over the summer, the former director general of the WTO, Roberto Azevedo, stepped down. It was a year earlier than anticipated. And now we have a scheduled announcement in the coming week of a new director general. There have been two primary candidates. One candidate seems to have the nod, but might not be a smooth choice. So, Jim, can you walk us through what's going on in Geneva at the WTO?
Certainly, Bob, but maybe we should back up in terms of how the World Trade Organization actually selects its director general. It's a very formalized process, and it goes through certain phases, and it begins with a nomination phase. That kicked off earlier this summer. There were 8 nominees that sort of made it through the initial nominating process. That number has been dwindled, as you pointed out, and we got down to last week when it was announced that there was one candidate that was most likely to be a consensus pick. Now, I have to step back here. Two things are happening. One is that there is a process by which the so-called Troika, which is the head of the 3 major departments at the World Trade Organization, essentially meet with all of the important delegations and member countries to say, what do you think of these candidates? And that's how the cuts are made. And the other thing is that the WTO likes to operate on consensus. That means everybody agrees. Flip side of that, of course, if anyone objects, then candidates is struck. And so that's the process, sort of getting through, basically taking temperature to see who can get the most support. Last week, it was announced that the candidate most likely to achieve a consensus was Nigeria's Dr. Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala. She is a development economist by training. She spent a quarter of a century at the World Bank. She has twice served as finance minister. Now, the fly in the ointment here is that the United States looks to be opposed to her appointment as director general. On the same day that Okonjo-Iweala was announced as a surviving candidate, the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative issued a statement backing a different candidate. That would be the candidate who was the last person eliminated in the process. And the statement also went on to say that the World Trade Organization is deeply in need of reform. It must be led by somebody with, let me quote him here, real hands-on experience in the field, pointing to the fact that Okonjo-Iweala experiences in finance. She worked at the World Bank. She's not a trade expert per se. So the interesting question, as the WTO meets on Monday as scheduled, whether the United States will formally block her appointment. The Trump administration has already used its veto power on the issue of the appellate body. This is sort of the final review panel for the WTO assessment. Because the Trump administration has opposed the appointment of new members of the appellate body, it effectively has ceased to operate.
And we should note that body has, its decisions are binding, which when it was set up, the U.S. had agreed to at the time. It's now kind of chafed under those decisions.
Correct. And in essence, since there's no final ruling, there are no rulings at all. Now, under the terms of the WTO's constitution, member states could force a vote. Now, that has never happened. Doesn't mean it can happen, but it's never happened. And the obvious deterrent to forcing a vote is that it would clearly anger the Trump administration. Again, this is assuming the Trump administration blocks the appointment. The United States is the WTO's largest contributor. It was instrumental in its founding, which suggests that if the Trump administration does say, nope, we don't agree with this choice, that maybe the most likely outcome will be for the WTO to kick the can down the road. And to link back to our previous conversation, to see what a Biden administration, if we get a Biden administration, would do. And again, the WTO should have the benefit, given what we think is going to happen here domestically in terms of the election, of knowing by Monday who the next president of the United States is likely to be.
Do we know, Jim, so the U.S. has, as part of its messaging so far, the Trump administration has indicated a strong need for reform and in addition to the expertise level needed to carry out that. It has talked about the organization being involved in unfair rulings against the U.S. and about not treating China in a way that's part of a fair playing field as well. But do we have a sense from the U.S. and or other leading countries about what their main priorities are that the WTO should be dealing with in terms of global trade?
Yes. And there are several layers to the answer to that question. I would think fundamentally for most countries other than the United States, the top priority is keeping the WTO as an effective operating institution. Again, why was the WTO created? Because previously, when countries got into trade disputes, there was no ultimate resolution. The WTO, for all its flaws, and it has plenty, provided that kind of conclusion. It stipulated, this is how we decide the case, and if you won the case, this is what you're allowed to do. I think that's number one. Number two, there are real concerns, particularly among major Western industrialized democracies, that China has exploited the rules. So on this kind of, I'll be very clear. The Trump administration is not the only member of the WTO that's unhappy with the rules of the WTO. Again, I think if you look to the Japanese, you look to the Europeans, they'd like to see changes as well. They just don't agree with the Trump administration on the method of effecting those changes. And again, one of the big things to see if we do get a Biden administration is how quickly the Biden administration moves on these issues and what position it stakes out. I think a third thing, if you want to get more specific, there's a great deal of concern about rules involving subsidies. That is, ways in which governments sort of intervene in markets and help their countries, their exporters, or inhibit and strap importers. And that's a big issue. Now, I will note on that score that much of what is in Joe Biden's trade agenda could potentially run afoul of WTO rules or complicate efforts to deal with subsidies. It's because it's a big issue. And the reality is everybody's against subsidies by other governments. They kind of like the subsidies they give, though they tend not to call what they do subsidies for obvious reasons, because it's not permitted under trade rules.
For anybody looking for an illustration of that, just check out the Airbus versus Boeing ongoing epic dispute between the two major aircraft makers.
Correct. And I think this is a specific example of a broader problem that is not easily rectified, which again highlights an issue, which is the criticisms the United States government has about the trade system aren't directed solely at China. Again, they are directed against some of our closest trading partners. The Trump administration, President Trump in particular, has been very vocal and clear about that. But a number of those beefs predate the Trump administration. So it's not as if Democrats are happy with the state of trade relations with Europe. And flip side, the Europeans have many complaints on that side. Countries can be very close in terms of their politics and have very long-standing heated debates over trade policy. And there I would offer up my favorite being the U.S.-Canada dispute over softwood lumber. It might seem like it's a small thing, but it is a major irritant in U.S.-Canadian relations and has been going on for decades now and still hasn't been resolved. Bob, let's pivot and talk to a vote that's taking place in Southeast Asia, specifically in Myanmar. Recent reporting from Human Rights Watch notes that Myanmar's electoral process is undermined by systemic problems and rights abuses that will deprive people of their right to fairly elect their government. So tell us what's going on in Myanmar, Bob.
Well, I think it's first worth pointing out that Myanmar is still not that far removed from a full-scale military dictatorship. It's only the second national election since 2011 when it started moving in the direction of democratic reforms. But baked into that reform effort are some checks and some provisions that, and then some practices, frankly, that have occurred since then that give people a lot of pause for concern. And when you have, you know, human rights and pro-democracy watchdogs saying Myanmar is holding these elections under all sorts of shaky circumstances. For one, the country still has discriminatory citizenship laws that bar their Rohingya minorities or Rohingya Muslims as voters and candidates. Under the country's laws, 25% of parliamentary seats are reserved automatically for the military. This is part of the brokering that went on to create some of the democratic opening. Government critics have been prosecuted. There's been unequal access of political parties to government media, which is a dominant media form. And there's no independent election commission or the mechanism for resolving complaints about the elections. Let's talk a little bit more about the Rohingya. There's more than a million of them who fled the country after a crackdown that the UN has called ethnic cleansing. They've been invited back to return. They, for understandable reasons, are very wary of that. Most of them reside in Bangladesh, a significant number in India as well. And there's about 500,000 to 600,000 that still reside in the country. But again, their conditions and their circumstances are extremely problematic. And because of what the government's actions, the government-led forces actions against the Rohingya several years ago has brought it to the attention of international human rights courts and had brought a lot of scorn down on the country's previously highly revered Nobel laureate Aung San Suu Kyi, who's the top civilian official in the country. Her party is the National League for Democracy. It had a landslide victory in the last election in 2015, is expected to do extremely well in these elections and kind of holds most of the electoral cards. And so it's just, there's a lot of questions about the country's ability to really move towards a democracy that the country deserves, but that would reflect true sense of participation in a country that has enormous number of minority groups, a number of restive minorities, it should be said as well, who feel like they are underrepresented or disenfranchised. And so elections have typically been seen as, especially in a country like Myanmar, opportunities to show progress. But there's a great deal of concern that this election, also being held under a increasing outbreak of the COVID-19 pandemic, could just be another excuse for people to vent resentments about a circumstance in which they're not able to fully take part in an electoral exercise.
Have we seen the U.S. government, particularly the State Department, speaking out on the situation we're seeing in Myanmar, Bob?
We have generally seen U.S. concern about Myanmar, and the U.S. also has a consistent, although it must be said, somewhat muted comments regarding democracy and free and fair elections in many of the places that have held elections in the past several months. And I'm thinking of places like Belarus, but also in Africa. There are sort of pro forma statements that come out, but it's not really clear what the U.S. is willing to do to sort of back up that. In the case of Myanmar, the U.S. has been regularly pushing for one, for better treatment of the Rohingya, Muslims, but also more participatory democracy. I think there it's, as with a lot of things in that region, the U.S. is balancing the concern about not pushing too hard in a country that could come under China's sway a bit more. China has included Myanmar, I believe, on its Belt and Road Initiative. It would love to continue to have access to the incredible resources in a country like Myanmar for commerce and sort of netting it together into this fabric of Chinese trade partners. So the concerns are a bit tempered, but I do think certainly the very outspoken U.S.-based NGO community that monitors human rights has expressed its concern about Aung San Suu Kyi's sort of unwillingness to speak out on abuses, especially toward the Rohingya minority. And so this will be another interesting case if we come out of this coming weekend with a very flawed Myanmar election process, to what extent will the U.S. speak out on it? Jim, let's turn to the figure of the week portion of this podcast. We have resumed starting with our audience figure of the week, and listeners know they can vote on or tweet us at CFR_org with their audience figure. Jim, this week our audience selected 4 dead in Vienna attack. Can you tell us a little bit why they selected this figure?
Certainly, Bob. What the audience figure of the week refers to is an attack that took place on Monday night when a gunman fired dozens of shots on customers sitting outside in Vienna's central district. The attack killed 4 people, wounded nearly 24 others. The attack itself came on the heels of a series of knife attacks in France that began with the beheading of a French teacher who had dared to show his students the cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad that had precipitated the attack 5 years earlier on the offices of the satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo. Now, in the Vienna case, as with the killing of the French teacher, the assailant was quickly cornered and killed by police. The news that has come out since Monday about the attacker in Vienna has been disturbing. It was a young male Austrian and North Macedonian citizen who had previously been sentenced to 22 months in detention for trying to join the Islamic State. The individual had subsequently been released from prison early. Making matters worse is that Slovakian authorities alerted Austrian authorities this summer. The gentleman in question had traveled to Slovakia to try to buy ammunition for his AK-47. Now, that, of course, raises big questions about what was happening in Austria in terms of trying to track known or suspected terrorists. I'll also note that the Islamic State has claimed credit for the attack. It's hard to say, though, whether it had any role whatsoever. One of the things these attacks has created is a surge in political interest in dealing with or confronting Islamism. And I'll note that Austria's Chancellor Sebastian Kurz has joined with French President Emmanuel Macron in declaring the need for a common European front in a war on Islamism. And Kurz has said that he's going to seek to build an alliance at the next summit of EU leaders that's directed against political Islam. It's not clear what that means, but obviously terrorism and the issue of immigration and integration of Muslims into the body politic in Europe is once again front and center in a lot of countries in Europe.
The attack in Vienna, and as well as the ones in France, were alarming because particularly those types of attacks in the places they occurred do not happen so frequently and had not happened in a while. But I've also seen reports that say, you know, be careful of overblowing this, that the Islamic State is actually very much in retreat and not a pervasive threat in Europe. So do you think there's a concern of an overreaction to this, or maybe it's paying more time on the radicalization front that had been neglected, among other things?
Well, Bob, there's always a chance of overreaction to incidents like that. I will note that Chancellor Kurz has given a number of public statements in which he has tried to emphasize that there is no fight between Christians and Muslims or between Austrians and migrants. He wants to frame this as a battle between civilization and barbarism. But as we all know in politics, the fact that good words are being spoken doesn't mean that you can't unleash uglier sentiments in many of these countries. And we've seen that over the last decade. And I think that's going to be a big challenge for all of these countries because the vast majority of Muslim immigrants in these societies are law-abiding, want to go about their business, and aren't involved in extremist activities. And there's also the real big challenge for many European countries, which don't have a long history of integrating new newcomers in the societies to be able to do it well. So we'll see how this goes. Obviously, leadership can be critical in terms of steering which way the debate goes, but I think one would have to be naive not to acknowledge the potential for some of the uglier sentiments to come back to the forefront in the weeks and months to come, particularly if we see these attacks repeated, and particularly if they happen on an even larger scale. What about you, Bob? What is your figure of the week?
Well, Jim, my figure is also a number, also relates to a grim set of trends. It is 50, as in 50%, and that relates to the fact that the average daily enemy-initiated attacks in Afghanistan in the last quarter were 50% higher than the previous quarter, and that the last quarter being July through September. And that's according to the Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction, a U.S. position that tracks these things. And we've certainly seen this in terms of our reporting. We put out a morning newsletter, and we've cited Afghan reports, one shocking one after another, that have been occurring with increasing frequency. It's just showing that, you know, Afghanistan remains an incredibly violent, deadly place. The different sort of strain of this, and these are mainly Taliban attacks, though not exclusively, is that these are attacks on Afghan official positions, whether it's Afghan defense positions or other government positions, and not as many, if any, against U.S. positions. And this is one of the offshoots of the U.S.-initiated peace deal with the Taliban that is supposed to lead to a drawing down of U.S. forces and peace between the Afghan sides. Now, the Department of Defense has said, you know, that this number of attacks, this violence is unacceptably high, and it could undermine the peace agreement. So we'll have to see whether there's any movement towards pressuring the Taliban in particular to stop these. We've also seen reports of attacks, also really brutal attacks, mounted by the Islamic State. I think there was a recent one at Kabul University. So it's just a reminder that Afghanistan, unfortunately, almost 20 years after the ouster of the Taliban, is not going to go quietly into that good night as the U.S. winds down its troop levels, but in fact will be a violent place.
Bob, in terms of the winding down of U.S. troop levels in Afghanistan, last month, National Security Advisor Robert O'Brien gave a speech saying that the United States was going to go down from about 5,000 troops now to 2,500 troops at year's end. President Trump shortly thereafter sent out a tweet that was slightly ambiguous but could be read as saying, no, he wanted to get to zero by the end of the year. And the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff announced that he didn't consider the National Security Advisor's statement to be operational guidance for the Defense Department. Has any of that shaken out? Any clarity as to whether we're going to see changes in U.S. troop deployment in Afghanistan?
It's a really good question, Jim, and it's pegged to the keen desire of President Trump to draw these forces down, to continue to press for that to happen, and to be less swayed by things like a spike in violent conditions or whatever. General Milley, I believe, was talking about the concern about U.S. drawdown being conditions-based and not just occurring despite everything happening. So to answer your question, I haven't seen any reporting, at least in the open, from public sources showing that that is going to change. I think that our intent on the drawdown, I think barring some major incident that would involve death to, say, U.S. forces or personnel. I would also say, frankly, it appears to be some sort of a dysfunction, frankly, between the Pentagon and the National Security Council on this issue. So perhaps there's things going on that we're not aware of, and they've improved their messaging and coordination on this, Jim. But based on that recent set of announcements, it really spoke to real problems there. So and I have not seen anything in the open that would counter that.
Fair enough.
Jim, how about you? Who or what is your figure?
Bob, my figure of the week is a person, and it is Abiy Ahmed, the Prime Minister of Ethiopia and the 2019 winner of the Nobel Peace Prize. You might recall that he won the Nobel Peace Prize for his efforts to settle the long-running conflict that Ethiopia has with neighboring Eritrea. Well, Prime Minister Ahmed is in the news this week, not for offering olive branches, but for brandishing the sword. He has declared a state of emergency and sent troops into Ethiopia's restive Tigray region, a decision that might mean a civil war. Now, just to locate things for people, Tigray is in the northern part of Ethiopia. It borders on Eritrea and Sudan. Its population is roughly about 5 million people in a country of 108 million. And I should note that Ethiopia, like the United States, like Germany, is a federal system with a national government and state governments. Now, Prime Minister Ahmed's move came in response to an alleged attack by the Tigray People's People's Liberation Front, the TPLF, on a federal military base. Now, the TPLF is the party that runs the state government in Tigray, and for 40 years, it led Ethiopia's national government. That is, the TPLF led things nationwide until they were ousted in 2018 by protests that ultimately brought Ahmed to power. So clearly in this situation, no love is lost between the TPLF and Ahmed. And that relationship has actually worsened over the last year or so. The TPLF have harbored former government officials that have been wanted by the federal government in Addis Ababa. And I'll note that the TPLF held state elections in September in defiance of the national government's decision to postpone all local elections because of COVID-19. Now, this state of emergency is set to last for 6 months, and we're not really sure what has happened since then, because phone and internet links to the Tigray region have been cut off. It appears that the TPLF and federal forces have engaged in some skirmishes. There have been reports, totally unconfirmed, that dozens of federal troops have been killed. I think it's important to understand that the TPLF forces are pretty well armed and well trained by all accounts. And this is coming against the backdrop of a number of other problems that Ethiopia is facing, most notably the fact that ethnic tensions are bubbling up across the country, not just in Tigray. One of the decisions that Ahmed made when he came into power was to sort of let up on the repression that had been true in Ethiopia. But one of the consequences of that is that public discourse and public infighting has grown. Groups are fighting over things like turf, over resources, political power, and the like. Indeed, this weekend, more than 50 people were killed in a different part of Ethiopia when an armed rebel group attacked a series of villages. And then, of course, as we've talked about on the podcast before, Ethiopia is engaged in some conflict with Egypt over the Great Renaissance Dam. Again, Egyptians are concerned that the dam, which sits on the upper reaches of the Blue Nile, will restrict the water flow into the Nile, water flows that Egyptian life depends upon. So a lot is happening right now in Ethiopia. And again, if things get worse and signs are pointing in the wrong direction, you could have spillover effects to Eritrea, into Sudan, and not just internally within Ethiopia.
It's really a quite a remarkable turn of events involving Ethiopia, whether it's the leader being a Nobel laureate, presiding over a country that looked like it was on the move. It was potentially economic development success story, building this great dam and so forth. And yet now it seems to be riven by this conflict that is only trending more serious. It is locked in a worsening dispute with Egypt and I guess Sudan over the impact of its dam on the Nile. And also the U.S., from what I've seen, Jim, is while it has been an ally, generally speaking, of Ethiopia in terms of actions in the Horn of Africa against extremist groups, it has certainly taken Egypt's side on the dam dispute. Do you get any sense of whether there's any kind of U.S. or other influence that might be trying to help steer this conflict?
If the United States is extending its diplomatic offices to Ethiopia today, it is doing it under the radar. We haven't seen any big visible effort by the United States. I will note that Secretary of State Mike Pompeo did send a tweet out this week calling for de-escalation, expressing the U.S. concern over reports that the TPLF has attacked Ethiopian military bases, clearly signaling at least the United States is convinced that the attacks did take place. But we haven't seen any big initiatives going forward. And it's not all clear in a situation like this how much influence outside powers can have over the outcome.
This development and other things we talked about in the podcast are just another examples of how, while the U.S. is transfixed by its election, the world continues to turn and churn, and we'll be facing whatever administration takes over.
Very true, Bob. Very true.
And that's our look at the world next week. Here's some other stories to keep an eye on. Germans mark the anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall. Belize is set to hold a general election, and Veterans Day is marked in the U.S.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave us a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. Please note that opinions expressed on The World Next Week are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program is produced by Zoe Collins with senior producer Jeremy Shirley. Special thanks go out to Anna Shortridge, Kara Jackson, and Ken DeRoss for their assistance. This week, our recording engineer was Zoe Collins. Thank you, Zoe. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons. This is Jim Lindsay saying goodbye.
And this is Bob McMahon saying so long and stay healthy out there.